KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This much can be said about Novella Carpenter's new book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. It's a lot of fun to read. It's the tale of one woman's adventures planting crops and raising pigs in a gritty section of Oakland. It's received rave reviews in the New York Times and other papers, in part because it's witty and well-written, and in part because the idea of raising your own food in the middle of urban America has widespread appeal. You don't need the back 40 to do it. Just a little space off the back porch will do. A conversation with Novella Carpenter about collecting eggs, milking goats, and raising rabbits, all in the shadow of BART and I-80, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. I have a farm on a dead-end street in the ghetto. I harvest lettuce in an abandoned lot. I wake in the mornings to the sounds of farm animals mingled with my neighbor's blaring car alarm. So begins Novella Carpenter's new book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. Carpenter and her boyfriend have spent the last few years in a rough patch of Oakland figuring out urban lessons most of us never consider, like dumpster diving in order to feed your pigs. Transforming the urban landscape usually conjures up images of condos and gentrification, but kind of the opposite is in play here. As Carpenter put it in a recent interview, when you're an urban farmer, you have the chance to use your body and dig and sweat and harvest. Those are verbs we don't get to use very often. Fella Carpenter's book is funny and blunt. You learn what it takes to go eyeball to eyeball with a turkey you've raised and now want to eat. Around the country, the idea of urban farming is getting plenty of attention, and Novella Carpenter is one of the reasons why. Her book, again, is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Pleasure to have you with us. Tell us what your farm looks like.
Well, these days the farm is, it still continues to be near downtown Oakland. I was very lucky to keep my space there. And there's, of course, it's high summer, you know, it's amazing amounts of zucchini that I fob off onto my neighbors. Lots of tomatoes and cucumbers and basil and squash. And then in the back area, I have goats. I have actually right now 6 Nigerian dwarf goats, which are used for milking. And then I have about 12 rabbits and 6 chickens. So they're all running around sort of, you know, sometimes they get out loose and run around the street. And that's kind of, that's the scene there.
And describe the rest of the scene, mm-hmm. the neighborhood
so
in which it is.
So that's the farm. The neighborhood is, the name of my neighborhood is Ghost Town. And the reason it's called that is because there are so many abandoned buildings and lots. And it's kind of a place that's been traumatized by development and other things. So, and it is definitely, you know, there are people that are selling drugs and, you know, there's some prostitutes. There's guys with the shopping carts collecting cans, going to the recycling center. So it is definitely an urban environment. You know, there are things that characters on the street who are, you know, prone to city activities. And so then you have this kind of mashup of, you know, a goat running down the street following the shopping cart guy. It's fun.
And describe the other part of this, the part that you have in common with Henry David Thoreau.
Well, my thing is that I'm a person that doesn't have a lot of money. I never have. And when one considers wanting to urban farm or farming in anywhere, you know, you kind of need some capital. You need money. And one of the things and that was one of the things that always had stopped me before. So when I rented the apartment that my boyfriend and I live in now, part of the appeal of the apartment was this huge 4,500 square foot abandoned lot, vacant lot. It had weeds and garbage in it. And when I saw that, I thought, farm. That has farm potential. It has a great aspect. It's full sun all day long, and Oakland is pretty warm. And so for me, it was sort of one of those things where I just cautiously dipped my toe in and began essentially squatting on the land. And now I've been lucky enough to have been squatting there for 6 years without too much incident.
And is this with the sort of benign approval of the people who own the land on which you farm?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where people often buy abandoned lots in Oakland and then sit on them as sort of an investment possibility. So I know that the man who originally owned the lot bought it for like $40,000, and he was just going to sit on it and then eventually build condos. But in that time between, you know, building the condos and having nothing there, you know, weeds grow and people start dropping garbage. And so I think there was – he wasn't very angry that I was sort of dropping corn in his space, you know, keeping the weeds down, you know, watching the property essentially. But he would – the owner of the property would come every once in a while and tell me, condos here. 3 months, you know, that kind of thing. And then I would get depressed and I would be like, oh, they're going to bulldoze my beautiful farm. But then I would always kind of get a reprise from that.
And so in a way, we spent the first hour of this program today talking about whether or not we're at the bottom of the housing market and whether things are looking up. You're in this kind of funny bad news, good news situation, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the recession for squat urban farmers is a good thing. I mean, I'm pretty excited about it. So yeah, it is kind of a paradox.
Subtitle of your book, Education of an Urban Farmer. And you talk in the book some about that phrase when you sort of – someone said that that's what they were, a friend of yours that you met, and you sort of adopted that as your own identity. Describe what that means, being an urban farmer, and why that seems to be resonating right now, not only in Oakland but in lots of cities around the country.
Oh, it's amazing. When I went on book tour, I've met so many people in New York and L.A. who are all doing various forms of urban farming. I think it's sort of – it just says it all. I mean, when I first heard the term – you know, I had been raising chickens and bees, and I had vegetables, and I had sort of been contemplating raising meat birds. And I was kind of freaked out by it in a way. And then I met some other people who were doing a similar thing. And they were like, yeah, we're urban farmers. You know, we live in the city. We farm in the city. We use the resources of the city in order to do our farm. And then I think that is – it just makes sense in this way because we can use the waste stream, like, for instance, the dumpster dive-fed pigs. Those are things that you could never do in the country. And so I think that's sort of the appeal starts to happen when you're sort of like, wow, I can actually be a city person. I can enjoy the delights of the city, which is museums and seeing your friends and riding a bike to the store, you know, or to a rock show. But also having this thing where you have a really intense conversation with the land and animals and this connection to nature. And I think that's why it's really hitting a chord. You know, it's also because this year or last year was the first year that more people lived in the city than anywhere else in the world. So it became this thing where we are a world that lives in the city. And so we need to grow our own food in the city.
Novella Carpenter, our guest this hour, her new book is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. And for you, it was very consciously to be a part of the city. You're someone who kind of grew up in the kind of old hippie back to the land movement. That's part of what your parents represented. You've kind of taken a 180 on that. You're representing part of what your parents wanted, but you're doing it in a completely different locale.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to rebel against your parents. That's
even if they rebel.
Even if they were rebelling, yeah. I know so many people, so many punks that are children of hippies, because the last thing you want to do if your parents were hippies is wear tie-dye and listen to the Grateful Dead. Like, that is horrible. And so I think a lot of people rebelled by being punk or squatting or doing those kind of things where you take it to another extreme. But of course, you know, as we get older, we start to kind of, you know, realize like, wow, my parents did really have some good ideas. Like, I remember that milk from our Jersey cow was delicious. And so those kind of urges, you know, to actually try to do things with your hands and grow really good food you know, you realize how important that was and how special that was. But, you know, you have to do it in your own way. And so my mom's funny. She's really proud of me. And we grew up in rural areas. You know, she lives in rural Washington State, Shelton, Washington. And she told me the other day, like, I dug up my parking strip and now I'm growing. I have an urban farm. I'm like, Mom, come on. So, yeah.
And you dedicated the book to her. So
I did.
You still have that fundamental connection. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, too, about the point of urban farming being something that is particularly needed in urban areas, which is the availability of healthy food. You mm-hmm. often write in the book about you're growing all of this, but you are interested in making sure that it's used by people in the neighborhood because there isn't that much available. Let me just read this one portion where you talk about that. You write, the production of food is a beautiful process. Germination, growth, tending, the harvest, every step a miracle, a dialogue with life. I could have hoarded all the food for myself, processed the tomatoes into cans, pickled the cucumbers. I would have had a groaning cupboard of homegrown food. But then I would have eaten alone. Visitors to my garden keep coming all through the summer and into the fall, sometimes into the night. They didn't need to come under the cover of darkness. When they picked a tomato from one of my carefully tended vines, they had my blessing. I understood it more than ever. We were all just trying to survive.
Yeah, when you live, I mean, you know, it's funny because as a gardener, not a farmer, you're protective of your crops. And maybe as a farmer, you are too. But, you know, if somebody steals your tomato, you're angry, right? And I used to be like that. But when I moved to our neighborhood and I started squatting on this land, which, you know, basically I was had free access to this land anyway, so I didn't own it. And when people would come by and they would harvest food, at first I was sort of like, wow, someone picked my favorite cabbage or whatever. And then I started to look around and I realized, like, this neighborhood is really hungry. Like, this neighborhood yeah. has no access to fresh produce. And that is, you know, a problem in many parts of the country where it's these things called food deserts, where there's no grocery store. There is the liquor store and that's it. So, of course, people are eating chips and, you know, soda pop. And so to have a farm, to have this like farm in the middle of that, that is open, you know, that totally the gate is open, come on in, eat whatever, it's really important to me. And so I came to see people when they would go pick, when, you know, I'd watch people from my kitchen window picking food. I was like, I got really excited. Like, that's a great thing to see. And it warmed my heart. And it sort of proved to me that I was a farmer. Like, I mean, farmer is a word that, you know, I still feel a little ambiguous about. But if I'm feeding, if I'm growing something that's feeding other people, then I am a farmer.
Do you see yourself then as part of a movement? Do you see what you're doing as having this particular social good connected to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a social justice aspect to it for sure. That, you know, I think one of the problems with slow food, I mean, I love the concepts of slow food, but the problem is it can feel a little exclusive. And so that, you know, by actually doing stuff, farming in a sort of an inner city, whatever people call it, inner city, creates this more dialogue, you know. So the food is actually being produced there. And so people can come in and tell me, you know, for instance, it's a whole multicultural neighborhood that I live in. So, you know, the Yemeni storekeeper comes over and tells me, oh, yeah, you should do this with your bees, you know. So everybody has advice and it's a dialogue instead of kind of a, you know, dogma.
I love the comment from Michael Pollan, who's sort of the rock star, you know, writer celebrity of everything that has to do with food. And he wrote on the dust jacket of your book, if you think that the local food movement is getting a tad precious, then you'll relish Farm City, Novella Carpenter's captivating account of the funky little farm she created, puts a whole new twist on the agrarian tradition. And it is kind of, it's not the anti-Chez Panisse, but it gives it a whole different twist.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it just makes what it does is it makes it possible to people. It opens it up. So you're just like, you know what? You want to eat arugula, but you don't want to pay $8 a bunch for it. Well, guess what? You can buy some seeds and grow tons of arugula. So it has this element of empowering people.
What did you think of the Obamas putting in a garden on the West Lawn? Was that too precious, or did you think that was terrific?
No, that was awesome. I mean, I had known people who were sort of lobbying for them to do it. It's been something in the works for years. People have been like, you know, they really should grow vegetables. So when they did it, I was so filled with hope because they are the example for all Americans. You know, they're the quintessential family, and the fact that they're growing the organic fresh vegetables, you know, right there on the White House lawn is huge. And, you know, Michelle has bees now. And I'm hoping that she's going to get chickens someday.
What about goats or pigs?
I can't quite imagine the pigs yet.
Novella Carpenter, her delightful new book called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. Linda, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the importance of sort of getting up close and personal with your food and with, as you put it, the meat birds in particular. Why is that true? Why is it good to get to know what it is you're going to eat?
Mm-hmm. I think it's something that as urban Americans, we don't often think about meat as an animal. You know, it's something we order at a restaurant. It's something that just appears on salads, chicken, you know. But if you think about it, if you are actually doing some urban farming and you have a chicken on your property, you start thinking about what it means when you put chicken on your salad. And so, you know, meat is a very precious thing, in my opinion. And I don't think it's – I think that – for me, at least, I need to eat meat for my health. But I also think it's important to at least try to see what it looks like when you are going, what it means to eat meat. And that does involve killing an animal.
And you're very precise about that. I mean, I'm curious about your intent in doing that, in writing about how you kill a turkey, how you kill a chicken, the tools that you need. I wrote in the column of the book at one point, yikes, because of, you know, you're very descriptive about what that entails. But you think that's important for people to know and not be sort of oblivious to that part of what it takes.
I think it is. I mean, I think it's important for people who eat meat. You know, I often have people who are meat eaters who will say something like, can I come to your house and watch you harvest a chicken or a rabbit, because there's this yearning for connection to your food. There's a yearning for knowing how things go down, because otherwise we're like children. You know, we just don't know. It just shows up. It's at the grocery store and we just buy it in this Saran wrap, you know, pack. And so it's kind of a secret knowledge. And I'm, you know, and for me, it's a very, you know, it's a very ceremonial process. You know, I like to burn something and sort of give thanks to this animal's life and make it the precious thing that it is. So it isn't just a casual dalliance.
How self-sufficient can you be? There's a funny, in part, passage in your book where you describe a month, I think it was the month of July, where you decided you were only going to eat essentially what was part of your garden. You had a few sort of exceptions that you worked out in terms of what you could barter, but basically it had to all come from the abandoned lot next door. And I want to ask about some of the funny parts of that experience in a moment, but is that the goal in the end? I mean, would you like to be able to sort of be totally self-sufficient?
Well, it's a question that always comes up. People are like, are you able to – what percentage of your you know, stuff are you able to grow? And so this was a way for me to sort of prove to myself that I – you know, that I could if I wanted to grow all the food that I eat. But what happens is when you do that, and it's a very American idea, like self-reliance, you know, like we can just, you know, it's self-sufficiency. And that was the goal of my parents, and it's a goal of many utopian societies. But in the end, what happens is if you live in a community like mine, there's no way that you can do that because you can't just be self-sufficient. That assumes that you live in a bubble. And that you would have to build these, you know, fences around your house and, you know, watch out for people stealing your tomatoes. And it makes you sort of a paranoid kind of person. And in the end, for me, what's more important is to share. That's why I sort of gear my thing away from being like totally self-sufficient. I could be. It would be a lot of really hard work. And I think it also makes you less open to conversations with people or, you know, you've become very isolated.
It's a funny portion of that experience where you talk about you're kind of craving carbs or whatever, and your corn isn't ready yet or whatever, and you wind up doing what?
Well, yeah, I kind of hadn't planned the carb thing very well. I thought I had this huge potato harvest, but then when I actually harvested the potatoes, I think I had like two. At one point, I was very, very carb starved, and I looked up on my mantle. I was sort of pacing the house, trying to figure out how I was going to make it through the month, and I looked up and I saw some corn that I had grown the last year that had been sort of an ornamental blue, beautiful blue Aztec corn, and I realized like, that's food. And so I like put it in the cornmeal and like ground it up and made cornmeal pancakes. And, you know, eating home decor, I didn't think I was going to reach that point. But at the same time, it's sort of like, you know, a lot of times we have these like decorative food. And if you think about it, that's good eating, really.
I want to ask you about pigs as well. There's a whole section in your book about the pig experience, which is really a lot of fun. And one of my favorite portions is where you describe how the pigs eat. You had two pigs and what they ate, and part of it goes like this. Their focus was amazing. While they ate, the pigs let out small sighs of approval. Their lip smacking was audible. At times, they would stop chewing and simply suck up the juices from the trough through their nostrils. They were the best dinner guests ever. Now that I thought about it, these pigs had probably never had food like this before. They'd probably only had their mother's milk, a few handfuls of pig chow, maybe a rotten apple. Now they were eating Chinese.
Yeah, a hot date for my boyfriend and I was to go to Chinatown and harvest stuff from the green bin there. And the pigs ate extremely well, lots of wontons and cake and those kinds of things. But one of the things that I found and that is still true is I love to feed everything. I love to feed my friends and people I don't know, but feeding animals is one of the most satisfying things because they're not going to pretend like they like something. You'll know if they like something. And the pigs were they loved all the food we brought for them. Peaches and cheese and, I mean, they ate really, really well.
And they're such fondness and affection that comes through in your writing about these two pigs in particular. But in the end, you butcher them and you get a lot of good eating out of those pigs. And how hard is that to reconcile, to have, and I'm sure this you get asked this question all the time, about the sort of affection that you develop for an animal and at the same time, you know you're going to kill it.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, it's funny because I don't see the paradox in it. I feel like these animals have been domesticated for thousands of years by us. And our relationship is sort of an extension. You know, it's a historical relationship that we have a culture built around, at least, you know, in the United States, of eating pork. You know, it is like this quintessential food, ham and bacon and salt pork, you know, from the pioneer times. And so for me to be feeding them and loving them is the way that they turn into the most delicious meat. So it's just a logical conclusion. The options, you know, once I had the pigs and they reached around 300 pounds, were limited. What would I do with these pigs? They were not, you know, they're farm animals. They're meat animals.
Especially the corner of 28th and Martin Luther King.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, are they supposed to go live free? And so these opened up all of those philosophical questions.
And for you, they go hand in hand. It's not one or the other, that loving and living and killing are interconnected.
Yeah. I mean, it is that you are loving them as well as you can. And then when it's time for them to go, you hope you are going to kill them humanely, and then you're going to celebrate them.
Novella Carpenter, her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. If you'd like to get engaged in urban farming, or if you already are and you would like to join our conversation, we'll open up the phone lines next. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your urban farming questions at forum@kqed.org. forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, back with Novella Carpenter and more in just a moment. This is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, urban farming. Our guest, Novella Carpenter. Her new book is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. And she'll be reading from that, by the way, coming up Sunday here in San Francisco, Noe Valley at Omnivore Books. Wonderful name for a bookstore. Omnivore Books, Noe Valley in San Francisco, Sunday at 3 o'clock. And we should also mention that more of Novella's work will be heard about later today on KQED Public Radio and the California Report. You can hear more about what's going on with Novella's farm in the Ghost Town neighborhood. That's this afternoon on the California Report on KQED Public Radio at 4:30 and again at 6:30 as well. Let's get to our callers, hear what they have to say and their questions about urban farming. Jazz joins us first from Berkeley. Jazz, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to offer a comment of appreciation to the speaker for bringing back the sense of seasonality into the city. One of my fondest memories of growing up in the country is of waking up and going out onto your porch and you'd see someone had left two grocery bags of zucchini, and then you had zucchini for
forever.
Weeks, and in return, you know, my mother was a fantastic cook, and we left on the Philbates porch two loaves of the best zucchini bread in the neighborhood, and that sort of thing. And you had a sense of when tomatoes were perfect. And now you can go over to Berkeley Bowl and choose from like 70 varietals of tomatoes with a carbon footprint that reflects the fact they're drop shipped from Japan or something. And it's not the same. It really isn't.
Yeah, Jazz, thanks. Thanks for the call. Talk a little bit, if you would, Novella, about how this movement is taking place, if we can call it a movement. It always feels a little pretentious to use that word. But you write about Willow Rosenthal and City Slicker Farms within your book. How prevalent is it getting to be, and that sense that Jazz was talking about that becomes so evocative in the late summer, I think, in particular.
Oh, I know. The eating is so good. Jazz, where do you live? I'll come drop off some zucchini. but yeah, it's one of the things that's beautiful about it is that, you know, you go to a farm stand City Slicker has a farm stand at 16th and Center on Saturdays. And it's so great because it's just overflowing with, you know, mulberries and tomatoes and chard and all of these things. And you watch the seasons progress. And so you really have a connection to what is actually in season here.
Leon in Berkeley, go ahead, please.
Hi. I wondered if it's legal to raise pigs and other animals in your backyard, because I was growing up in Berkeley and I remember some friends had a goat for a while, and then eventually the neighbors apparently made them get rid of it.
Yeah, great question, Leon. Thank you. What about the legality of what you can raise?
I know. Well, I am a total rebel, so I'll probably get caught now. But yeah, legalities in Oakland are basically this, that if it's you can have any farm animal except a rooster. It's totally illegal to have a rooster in Oakland. But any other animal is okay as long as your neighbors are okay with it. And so that's always the problem. You know, it's the problem even if they're legal. You know, if you have chickens and someone doesn't like it that lives next to you, they're going to make your life hell. And so you have to have good neighbor relations.
And do you know what that's like, sort of generally speaking? I mean, is that different in San Francisco, different in Palo Alto, different wherever you are?
It's different whatever city. It's a city-wide, it's city by city. So you have to look up your city ordinance, usually under animals or livestock. San Francisco, you can have chickens. I think in San Francisco, you can have four barn animals. So you could have four goats. But other cities like El Cerrito, you actually have to pay a yearly fee in order to keep chickens. So it varies.
A chicken tax.
Basically, yeah.
Well, you know, California cities need everything they can get these days to raise revenue. So are you a good neighbor? I mean, would someone want to move in next door to Novella Carpenter?
I mean, probably not. To be honest, I'm kind of, I think I'm a difficult neighbor to be next door. But, you know, a lot of my neighbors come from the country. A lot of them are from the countryside in Vietnam. And, it's totally normal to do the things that I'm doing. So people often don't even question the fact that it may be illegal .
So in some ways, this is a phenomenon that may be just beginning in some ways in different urban areas in this country, but would be seen as sort of the norm in other parts of the world.
Yeah, especially in the so-called developing world. It's, everybody in Havana, Cuba has a livestock in their backyard, pigs in the bathtub or those kind of things. And it's similar I went to Venezuela and I saw people keeping livestock on their decks, and in China, sheds, huge ducks on rooftops. And, you know, it's one of those things that as we go forward, we have to have rules for kind of keeping them sanitary and those kind of things. Because, you know, there's a historical precedent of, you know, people keeping a cow in a garage in Brooklyn and feeding it whiskey swill. You know, so those kind of things are problems.
Well, and I would think the other thing that people might have concerns about, or you might have concerns about in terms of consuming what you grow, that, you know, Oakland is not exactly the most pristine, right, environmentally mm-hmm. clean area. Mm-hmm. So what about what's in the soil? What right. about exhaust from I-80? What about all of those sorts of contaminants mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. are part of urban farming?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's definitely one of those things that the first thing you want to do is test the soil and make sure it doesn't have contamination in it. But then at the same time, you're kind of like, wow, I wanted to know that anyway. You know what I mean? Even if I'm not going to farm yeah. here, it's just good to know what's in the soil. And it just makes you more sensitive to our surroundings.
And what have you learned about that? Have you had your soil tested? Yeah. What do you know about the what you're producing?
Well, I had my soil tested and in the lot area, and that came out totally clean. But the backyard area actually has lead in it, lead from paint or yeah. other sources. So what I did was I did a big sheet mulch and put that down, and then put you know, compost and added amendments and things to that to sort of bind the lead.
Do you know where you can get your soil tested? I mean, people listening to this program mm-hmm. are interested in maybe I'll do this. What's the first step?
Yeah, you need to have it sent to a lab. And there's testing labs all over, there's one in Berkeley that I went to. So they're all over. Just Google labs.
Back to our callers. Diana in San Francisco. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Novella. I'm fascinated by what you're doing. And I've always been curious about having my own chickens in my backyard. I have a small backyard, and I think it would be great for my 4-year-old daughter, but I have no idea what's involved.
Yeah, it's well, you know, Diane, the chickens are the gateway urban farm animal. So just beware that once you start raising chickens, soon you'll have pigs in your backyard. No, I'm just joking. I'm just joking. But yeah, so chickens are really, really great. And they're so much fun to have, especially your daughter. It's so fun to have chickens around with young children because they're just the perfect size. You know, you can pick them up and then they make eggs and they're just beautiful to watch. What you need to do is I often recommend getting a good book. I like Keep Chickens is the name of it. And maybe take a class about keeping chickens. I actually work at a place called Biofuel Oasis, and we sell urban farm supplies, and I teach chicken keeping classes. And so maybe take a class or just get with someone, like another person who keeps chickens and sort of like a chicken mentor. But really all they require is a coop that they can sleep in at night that is predator proof, because believe it or not, out there in the city are raccoons and opossums that want to eat your chicken. So just a safe area for them, and then a run for them to sort of you know, have space for running around, and you're set.
Diana, thank you. What about resources that people can go to? You mentioned the store that you work at in South Berkeley. Are we beginning to see more places that cater to urban farmers?
I actually haven't seen that many. I mean, when I first started, I had to go trek out to the, you know, to the feed stores out yeah. in Contra Costa or, you know, wherever up in Sonoma. But more and more, I think that you're going to start seeing these people catering to the needs of urban farmers.
866-733-6786 is the number if you want to call in your question, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll get back to our calls in a second, but a couple of emails I want to get your reaction to. Elaine writes, I live in Berkeley, and I like the idea of raising meat birds, but I'm too squeamish to actually butcher them. A friend of mine takes her ducks to a processor. Mm-hmm. This is a friend who lives in Idaho. Do you know of any processors close to Berkeley? And you have sort of a painful saga, so to speak, about processing your pigs that mm-hmm. didn't go exactly mm-hmm. the way you
mm-hmm.
wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the pigs in particular, I had an experience of taking them to a slaughter facility that I felt wasn't exactly up to snuff. It was I was a little upset with how they dealt with the pigs. But having said that, I think that there are processing facilities, but you would have to drive the ducks or chickens up to probably, I think Sonoma is the closest one. and so I do think that, I know you're squeamish, but it is a really good idea to just try it yourself. It's really, really powerful to have that experience.
Here's a basic question. Where do you find your water?
Yeah, water is a big deal. So that's one of the biggest challenges, especially in California, third year of the drought, is, well, I actually access the water from my apartment. So, you know, my landlord pays for the water. However, sometimes he's upset about the bills. and so one of the things I started doing was gray water. So it's a way to collect water from your bathtub and your sink in order to go have it put into the garden. So it just, instead of going into the sewer where it's actually relatively clean water, it actually goes out and waters fruit trees and those kinds of things. And the gray water law has changed now. So more and more people can use water from their houses, which makes urban farming make even more sense because we use a lot of water in cities. So we can irrigate our crops with it.
Got a caller who wants to pick up on that same question about the use of gray water. Brian, go ahead with your question on that topic.
Yeah, great. I'm actually a neighbor over on 32nd and Adeline. Just bought a foreclosed place. What I did was I disconnected my P-trap and I put my buckets under the sink and I take it out to my garden every time it gets full. But I've heard that the laws for Oakland are pretty harsh on gray water. And you mentioned that they changed. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I don't know the exact law, but it was a state of California where they've relaxed the gray water laws. So it's going to become easier to get a permit for gray water systems. Now it's this Byzantine sort of elaborate system that you have to set up, and they're just going to make it a little bit easier. But you know, I would say that, and I mean this goes along with me like squatting and raising pigs. You know, it's one of those things that you should probably just do it, and then if someone comes to bust you, then you deal with it then, but it's pretty easy to put those pipes back in and stuff.
And our producer Kevin Guillory mentions, for those of you who are not like, and I'm one of those who is not very plumbing savvy, the P-trap that our caller mentioned is that curvy pipe that's under your sink, and so you can take that out and collect water from there. James writes, is there some program or model of large suburban land use directed towards food production? Many pieces of suburban land have little going on except laying fallow or landscaping. Do you know of any groups or entrepreneurs working on the use of that land for food production?
You know, I don't. I know a lot of people are really excited about the possibilities of the suburbs because suburbs have a huge amount of land, and often they use a lot of water to you know, water lawns. So it doesn't make sense. And it's one of those things that, again, people are leaving the suburbs. And so as people leave the suburbs, you're going to start seeing, I am betting, more and more people farming on those land.
We did a program a month or so back called about so-called shrinking cities, that some cities that are really struggling in the industrial Midwest, like Flint, Michigan, for example, are really thinking about trying to consciously reduce the size of their city, taking out vacant homes and making that land available for, in part, things like community gardens. Do you anticipate, do you see more interest in those kinds of possibilities developing?
Yeah, I think that's going to happen. Rebecca Solnit wrote a beautiful piece in Harper's, I think, 2 years ago about Detroit and going to these urban farms that had opened up. You know, houses were abandoned, and so people are just like, we're going to farm them. So it is happening more and more, especially in those places that have been hard hit. And it really increases the quality of life there.
To Dave in Redwood City. Dave, go ahead, please.
Hi. This probably isn't really a question, but it's a chicken story.
This is an hour where you can tell chicken stories. Go ahead.
Well, my mother, she's in her 90s now, but when she first retired, she finally decided she's going to carry out one of her dreams, which was to have chickens. And I was living there for a while, and she had 18 chickens. And first off, she had to get rid of the roosters because they would squawk too much and bother people, you know, when they started to get a little older. And then she kind of got mad at them because they would make her legs all bloody from pecking at them. So one time when I came home from work, all the chickens were gone and in the freezer. So I just thought, my dad and I just cracked up because, you know, she had been dreaming about chickens for years, and then they were all in the freezer.
Dave, thanks. Wow. Thanks for the story.
So I don't know if there's any, maybe she has some similar stories or something, but it's like it was the chicken, the eggs are great. But boy, they're pesky things.
Dave, thank you. The part of this also gets at something that you say you want people to understand, which is that this isn't necessarily easy, and that people who want to go into urban farming or have a few chickens really need to go with their eyes wide open.
Yeah. I think you can even romanticize urban farming, and it's one of those things that things are going to happen that you will find yourself doing things that you never thought you'd be doing.
And to David, who joins us in Hayward. David, go ahead.
I actually am really happy to have chickens, and I moved from Manhattan from a rooftop garden situation to Oakland and came into the chicken community in Greater Oakland, and then we've taken over.
There's a chicken community in Greater Oakland?
Yeah, there's like easily 24 people in Oakland with chickens that sort of all know each other through the web. But what's happened here in Oakland, Hayward with us, is that we've got a dozen chickens and all these eggs coming through. So my neighborhood is full of foreclosures. The neighborhood is kind of hard at the moment. Giving away eggs has made a community for us and sort of introduced us to people that, you know, the chickens get out, the turkey got out, you know. It's crazy, but we've sort of built a community that way, and I'm really intrigued by people like Forage Oakland, where people come and pick your fruit and then they exchange it. The community building of urban gardening is amazing.
David, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call and the story. Chung writes this from Berkeley, a similar point. I can't agree more with your guest about the pleasure of sharing the harvest with others. My dad used to rent a lot in UC Village Garden to grow vegetables, and it was the most pleasant time for him to invite others to come over and visit. I really wasn't able to understand until after he went back to his own town and asked me to take care of his garden. And then one day an old lady stopped by the lot and said, "It's so beautifully grown. Can I take this?" It was at that moment that I was suddenly overwhelmed by a sense of achievement and connection with community.
It's huge. I love that story about the sharing the eggs. I mean, it's one of those things where you just it just makes you feel human. It makes you just feel like part of a community, and sharing with the neighbors and knowing that they come from your chickens and that someone's going to be cracking their eggs into the frying pan. I mean, it's just an outrageously wonderful feeling.
We talked about Greywater a bit earlier, but we've got a little caveat on that front from Tony in El Cerrito. Tony, go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm absolutely for the collection of Greywater, but do not disconnect your P-trap. That keeps gases from the sewer line from getting into your home. The P-trap was invented because people were dying from sewer gases getting into their house, especially if you live like in an upstairs apartment. If you disconnect your P-trap, that opens up that vent line there. So any gases coming from the apartment below you or anywhere below you is coming up now through that vent line into your sink cabinet and basically into your house.
Tony, thank you. So, I'm really glad you called and clarified for that. So from your point of view, with the expertise you have as someone who works in plumbing, if people want to use their gray water, is there a safer way to do that? What do you recommend?
I recommend trying to catch it in the sink.
Okay.
Before it hits that drain line, it's going to require some ingenuity, and I couldn't actually say how to do that. But I'm sure we're figuring out how to farm in an urban area. I'm sure we could figure out how to collect our gray water from our sink rather than our drain line.
Tony, thanks. Thanks for the clarification.
And if I can just jump in, I've never disconnected my P-line. What I do is I actually have a washing machine, and that it goes I just have a long hose. And so when I wash my clothes, I just have the hose. I live in the upstairs apartment. And so the water just cascades down via gravity, goes into a 55-gallon drum where it's filtered, and then it goes into a wood chip mulch area. So it's sort of cleaned that way.
Let's go with a couple of other cautionary points here. Adam in Fort Collins, Colorado, joining us on the SiriusXM network, wants to raise a few concerns as well. Adam, please, go ahead.
Hi. I just had a question about swine flu and bird flu, that kind of thing. I'm a nursing student right now, and our city council just approved chickens in town, which is awesome. But one of the things they did talk about were possible kind of viral interactions between animals and people.
Yeah, it's a major issue. I mean, at one point I had too many chickens from my backyard. I think I had 35 chickens. And my neighbors are, a lot of them are from Southeast Asia who had been affected by avian flu. You know, they had family members who had actually gotten avian flu. And so it was very pressing for them. And the issue, the problem is, and this is really the thing, is that a lot of those, you know, those kind of animal to human diseases happen because of really bad and close quarters of the animals themselves. So factory farm conditions are usually the things that cause avian flu outbreaks. And so what you have to do is just, you know, of course, in your backyard, you have to monitor how many animals are keeping, because it is an issue. And sanitation is huge as well. So it is something that, you know, you don't want to get too crazy. You don't want to have too many animals that can't, you know, that are too close together on your urban farm.
Joe in Oakland, your same city, wants to challenge you a bit on this point. He writes, not to rain on the parade, but once you feel you can justify occupying someone else's private property to further your own social agenda, where do you draw the line? By what right do you decide that someone else's property is underused and underserves the community?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, you know, you have to be honest to live above the law. So I think you just have to make your own rules. In this particular instance, you know, the guy who owned the lot could have put a chain link fence. I mean, could have put a lock and locked up the garden. So I think I had tacit permission. But I do think that, you know, it's one of those things that you just have to consider. And as, you know, an economic crisis gets worse, I think we do need to do some radical things.
Lorraine wonders about your concern about, she writes, I was just curious if you're concerned about crime while farming in the city. And you describe one experience you had of almost getting mugged while you were bicycling through your neighborhood. How is that faring?
Yeah, I mean, crime is huge. And it's one of the major problems about my neighborhood is that there's a lot of drive-by shootings and people that don't have jobs and people who are malnourished. And so they seem crazy and drug use and all these things, these ills of the city. And I think that, you know, I try to just focus on the positive. I try to do what I can do. You know, I mean, we will have sometimes there'll be a garden party and there'll be a drive-by shooting, you know, right near where we're eating. And I think that those things are I'm not saying that it's my favorite thing, but at the same time, we recognize that there are major problems. And that's part of living in an urban environment is acknowledging that there's social injustice in the world.
Do you want to stay? Is Oakland home?
I love Oakland. I love it. I hope it comes across in the book. I gently make fun of it, too. I think it's a great city. It has beautiful architecture. It's got awesome people. The multicultural aspect of Oakland is such a jewel.
To Diane in San Jose. Diane, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Diane Hunt, and I wanted to let folks know that there actually is farming in the suburbs in Sunnyvale. There is a farm there called Full Circle Farm. It is an 11-acre organic sustainable farm that is actually on Santa Clara Unified School District land, adjacent to Peterson Middle School. We have an integrated curriculum with the middle schoolers and other schools in the district. It's only 2 years old, so we're going, you know, it's going great. We've been really well received in the community. And the farm was actually created by the neighbors and by the community. The land was actually slated for high density development, and the neighbors kind of rose up against it, and we formed a partnership with the school district.
Diane, thank you. Thanks for the story. It points to, reminds you of you know, Alice Waters and of Chez Panisse fame, working with middle schools in Berkeley and trying to integrate some of this into the curriculum of the schools. Is that a direction that you consider going into? I know you're teaching a class through your store, but is there more that you are interested in doing? You write about working with the Black Panthers and those sorts of organizations.
Right. I mean, I think it's great what Alice is doing, and the kids are really the heart of the matter because, you know, we have to change the thinking of children and get them used to harvesting vegetables and that kind of thing. I'm the worst at organizing that kind of stuff, though. So I leave that to nonprofits. People's Grocery and City Slicker Farms have programs for kids as well in Oakland. And there's a place called Puebla in East Oakland. So there's all these different organizations that are doing just that.
One last caller. Jack, go ahead. Jack, are you with us? Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, I lived in Oakland for quite a few years, and we gardened the heck out of our postage stamp size lot. So one thing is I just want to really encourage everyone to keep going. Since then, we've moved up to Hood River, Oregon, and we have about 7 acres, and now we raise a few cattle and have a much bigger garden. We do it with about 10 of our neighbors who don't have good gardening areas in their yards. And so we just continue to kind of expand that whole concept, and we make a big party out of it. Everyone comes over on the same day, and the kids come over too, and we're all out there together schmoozing, and the time really flies by. And to me, that's the best way to take the drudgery out of all the work of it is do it with other people. It makes it a lot of fun.
Jack, thanks. Thanks for the call and observation. And that sense of community and the fact that you do love Oakland, I do think really comes through in the school. So just a last thought, Novella Carpenter, on that. A line I'd like very much from your book is this, where you write, even in a plot next to the highway, germination is possible.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's interesting that it's urban farming can be a training ground, you know. You're an urban person, you start growing some arugula, then you start moving on to chickens, and then maybe, you know, you are able to have the resources to move to the country and be like a quote real farmer. But, you know, we have to let that opportunity happen. We can't just sort of sit around and dream about one day. We have to do it now.
And do it now, whether it's next to I-80 or wherever.
Wherever.
Novella Carpenter, our guest this hour. Again, her book is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. She'll be reading from her book at Omnivore Books in Noe Valley here in San Francisco Sunday at 3 o'clock. And if you'd like to hear more about her story and about farming, urban farming in the ghost town neighborhood of Oakland, tune in this afternoon to the California Report. Well, there will be more on this. That airs at 4:30 and again at 6:30. Novella, thanks for being on our program today.
Thanks. It was so much fun.
Pleasure to have you with us. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. Our intern, Paul Boyer. And the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson. Have a happy and productive and maybe a few farm-oriented parts of your weekend. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.